Hi, I'm Jeff Davis. On this podcast, I'm going to reach into the archives as I take some time off from my studio and the radio show. But you're in luck. You'll hear my conversations with two people who have made remarkable contributions to the wine industry. And my feature, Wine Uncorked. It's time to travel on the wine road.
And I said, are you kidding? I would just love to help you in your project if you would help me with my project, which is to find Zinfandel in its European home, which we think is Croatia. And he, of course, said, well, what is Zinfandel?
King, it was pleasant, pleasurable. It smelled good. It tasted good. It had a nice, creamy, long finish. It just beckoned for another sip. It brought a smile to everyone's face, and they just couldn't stop sipping and drinking it. And the rest is history.
He's Randy Ullum, the wine master at Kendall Jackson, who has made America's number one selling Chardonnay for over 25 years. That's unheard of. A big reason is the price. It sells for around $12 in the stores. But the flavor is incredibly layered for that price. It's the Kendall Jackson Vintner's Reserve Chardonnay. You'll hear how he can make it the way people expect it to be consistently year after year, regardless of the inherent changes in weather, droughts, disease, and the many challenges grapevines face from vintage to vintage. His story in the wine business is also an interesting one. It's coming up. I'm starting with Carol Meredith, high atop Mount Veeder overlooking Napa Valley, at the home she shares with her husband, Steve Legere. Steve is a winemaker, and they have their own label, Legere Meredith. One of the wines they bottle is Tribadrag. Tribadrag? You'll find out what that is. Carol was a professor in the Department of Viticulture and Enology at the University of California at Davis. She is so well-respected, she had appearances in the movie Somme, Into the Bottle, the second one of the trilogy. A very good movie, by the way, highlighting vintners and wine regions across the world. In 2001, following years of investigative research, and with the help of scientists in other countries, Carol solved the mystery of Zinfandel's ancestry. It's been in the U.S. for over a century, yet no one was sure how it got here. Even though she found the answer some nearly 20 years ago, I said to her, I still hear people say Zinfandel is a cousin or grandfather of Primitivo.
I get that all the time, and it used to piss me off. But then I began to be more patient with people and realized that if all you read is the popular press, then it's very, very easy to get the wrong idea. But the truth is that we have one grape variety that in California we call Zinfandel, and in southern Italy they call it Primitivo. And in Croatia today, they call it either Crljenik Kastelanski or Pribadrag. In Albania, they call it Kretosia. And I do believe there's a couple of other names. And then there are historic names, and the oldest name that we know about for this grape is Tribadrag. And so that is now considered the prime name. So it's all one grape. They're not cousins of each other. They're not related to each other. One is not the progenitor of the other. They're just all one grape variety. And that's not to say that there aren't any differences at all. I mean, even within a single variety like Pinot Noir, there are a lot of clonal distinctions. You can find subtypes. Sure. They're all Pinot Noir, but there are distinct, stable differences. It's the same with just about any old variety. For example, Syrah, there are some really profound clonal distinctions within Syrah. But nobody would ever say, oh, well, they're not the same variety. Yes, they are. They are just slight variants within a variety.
What started you on this project to identify the heritage of Zinfandel, and how long ago did you start that?
Well, when I first went to UC Davis in 1980, I started soaking up as much information as I could because I didn't have a background in grape. My background was plant genetics, crop plant genetics. And one of the things that I learned very early on was that Zinfandel had no European home and that Zinfandel wasn't known anywhere else in the world and that Zinfandel was considered by many to be California's own grape, whereas with Pinot Noir, you look to Burgundy. For Sangiovese, you look to Tuscany. Riesling, you look to Germany. But Zinfandel did not have a European home. There was nowhere that California producers could look to learn more about it, or to see what had been done historically, or even to look for new clones. And so it was assumed by many that Zinfandel was a native California grape because it didn't have any European home that we knew of. But anyone, and certainly there are native California grapes, and there are many Native American grapes, but anyone who knows anything about grapevine botany would only have to look at Zinfandel to see this is not a Native American grape because it looks like a European grape. So it was very clear to researchers that Zinfandel did come from Europe. We just didn't know where.
It does have that old world flavor to it, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly has a vinifera flavor. Yes, it doesn't have any of the foxy kind of flavor that you get from some American grapes.
So those are the Latin terms, right?
That's right, yeah. So it certainly looked like a European grape and tasted like a European grape. And a number of people had even noticed that it had some similarities to some wines from southern Italy and maybe even some wines from central Europe. So when I came along, and especially as we began to develop DNA profiling tools to answer questions about origins and relationships among wine grape varieties, that just stuck out to me as a question that I would just love to answer one day. Now, in the 70s, Austin Goheen, who was a grapevine pathologist at UC Davis, he noticed that Primitivo, growing in southern Italy, was very similar to Zinfandel. He was given some wine by an Italian colleague, and he thought it tasted like Zinfandel, and he said, "Can you show me these vines?" And his Italian counterpart said, "Well, it's just the local red. It's Primitivo." And when Austin looked at the vines, he said, "Well, you know, it looks a lot like Zinfandel. Can I take some cuttings back to Davis?" Which he did. And they planted them in the UC Davis vineyard. And they compared them side by side with Zinfandel. And they looked the same. But at that time, back in the 70s, there weren't any good tools for going beyond that to say, yes, they look the same, but are they the same? When some early biochemical methods emerged in the mid to late 70s, those were applied to Primitivo and Zinfandel. And yes, they were the same, but that technique was not very discriminating. You could group things, but you couldn't really prove that they were the same. So when the DNA methods came along in the 90s, I thought this is just something I would love to do. I would just love to see if I can find the home of Zinfandel. What I did have was I had Primitivo in our vineyard at UC Davis and Zinfandel, and I compared them at the DNA level, and they were they could not be differentiated. They had exactly the same DNA profile, which said to me that they are the same variety. I also did the same thing with a variety from Croatia that had been a candidate. It had been a suspect. And the name of that variety is Plavac Mali, right, which is the most widely grown wine grape along the Dalmatian coast of what is present-day Croatia. And so we did the DNA profile on Plavac Mali. We found it's not the same as Zinfandel, although there were similarities that, based on our experience looking at relationships among other grapes, we could say, you know, Plavac Mali is a very close relative of Zinfandel. It could be a parent of Zinfandel. It could be an offspring of Zinfandel because it shares half of Zinfandel's DNA. Hmm. So that pointed us in the direction of Croatia. And we weren't the first ones. I mean, it's pretty obvious when you look at a map of Italy and you look at the part of Italy where Primitivo is grown, it's the heel of Italy, and it's a region called Apulia. The coast of Apulia is the Adriatic Sea, and the Adriatic Sea is really quite narrow. And it's very, very easy for boats to go back and forth across the Adriatic to the other side, which is the Dalmatian coast. And that's also an ancient wine-growing area. Today we call it Croatia, but it's had other names in the past. So I wasn't the first to think maybe we should look in Croatia, but the tools simply hadn't been available before then. So when I decided I wanted to look there, my first problem was, well, okay, I don't know anybody there. And you can't simply, if you want to go exploring the grape varieties of another country, you really have to have some connections in that country. Maybe that country already has a collection of what represents their vineyard heritage. If they do, maybe you can get access to it, but you simply have to know people to do that. Or maybe they don't have a collection. Maybe you actually need to go stomping around in vineyards. But you have to have somebody to help you do that. You can't just get off the plane in Zagreb and go stomping around in vineyards. So I was stymied and really didn't know what I was going to do. And then what happened was there was a moment of great serendipity that happened to me in December of 1997. My research group at Davis had already had quite a bit of success studying classic wine grape varieties, developing collaborations in Europe, finding relationships among varieties. We had found the parents of Cabernet Sauvignon. We had found the parents of Chardonnay, the parents of Syrah. We had learned that all the grape varieties that had ever been grown in northeastern France all were generally related to each other through a couple of really important ancient wine grapes. And we had published all this, and so we were fairly well known in the world of grapevine genetics for doing this kind of work. So what happened in December 1997 was that I got an email from a fellow named Ivan Pejic. And he is a professor of plant genetics at the University of Zagreb. And he said, "Dear Dr. Meredith, my colleagues and I here are very interested in learning more about our grape varieties that we have growing in our vineyards, about our heritage. We're interested in learning what we have, what their history is, how they might be related, because we think that they are in jeopardy, that with modern global economic forces, they are in danger of being lost. And we think that your DNA methods that you have been using with some success would be very useful in our case, and we wonder if you would be willing to help us study our old grape varieties here in Croatia." And I said, "Are you kidding? I would just love to help you in your project if you would help me with my project, which is to find Zinfandel in its European home, which we think is Croatia." Yeah. And he, of course, said, "Well, what is Zinfandel?" Because that's not a name used anywhere else right. in the world except here in California. So I explained to him that Zinfandel was quite an important grape and that it was widely grown here in California, that it actually had an international market, particularly in Northern Europe, and that we felt quite strongly that it probably is a Croatian grape, and that in the course of studying all the varieties that he wanted to study, that we could also be addressing my project, which was to find Zinfandel in Croatia. And so this is December 1997. We immediately decided that our goals were just so widely overlapping and that we should work together. And 6 months later, I was there in May of 1998. And so I walked into the lobby, looked for the guy who looked nervous, and he was looking for the woman who looked like she was looking for someone. And so we immediately spotted each other. And then we walked out to get into his car, which was a little old Eastern European car, kind of, I don't think it was a Yugo. Maybe it was a Yugo. I don't know. But, you know, Croatia is part of the former Yugoslavia. It had been communist under Tito for many years. And it really, Zagreb has, at least at that time, had a heavily post-communist look to it, a lot of gray concrete, very uniform architecture, quite bland. And so we get into his little car, and he pops a cassette into his cassette player, And it's the Allman Brothers. So that broke the ice. You know, music is such a common language. That really broke the ice. We realized that we had a lot in common. Besides both being geneticists, we obviously liked some of the same music. And so
you were a fan of country rock yourself?
Not country rock, but blues rock, southern blues rock, you know. And I just love the Allman Brothers, and I love that kind of blues. I'm a huge fan of Stevie Ray Vaughan, but he died, and so you know, there's a lot of his stuff around too. And Yvonne Paich is also a fan of Stevie Ray Vaughan.
So what happened from that point?
Well, Yvonne and I, and he also introduced me to his colleague Eddie Maletich, who is another researcher at the University of Zagreb, and they were working together on this project to kind of catalog and understand all the old grape varieties of Croatia before they got lost. And I might add, as an aside, one of their fears was that the grape growers in Croatia were having a lot of economic troubles. This is a post-communist country. There were big Italian nurseries trying to convince the Croatian growers that they would do better if they ripped out their old traditional vines and planted Merlot and Chardonnay.
Yeah.
And this was a serious worry to people like my colleagues at the university, who recognized they had an ancient treasure chest here, and that under economic pressures, this was really at risk. And this is something every European grape-growing country has faced, and Croatia was just facing it a little bit later than some of the others. So what happened was we embarked upon our research. We spent about 3 years, during which we would go to vineyards, and at first it was me going to the vineyards with them, but later on, because I couldn't travel back and forth that much, and there was really no benefit to me doing that because Yvonne and Eddie could do all that, they would investigate, they would ask old growers, they would find old vineyards, they would take samples, they would send samples to us at UC Davis, and we would analyze the DNA of those samples and determine whether or not it was something we had ever seen before. If it was something we'd seen before, we'd tell them what it was. Yes, this is something we've seen before. If it was something we'd never seen before, then that became a new DNA profile for us, and they would tell us what it was called in Croatia. So we would add that to our database. After 3 years, some of those samples, they thought maybe they'd found the real deal, Zinfandel, but they turned out to be false alarms. But finally, in December of 2001, they sent us a new batch of samples, and once again, they thought maybe they really had it this time, and we were about to say, yeah, you said that before, but it was the real deal. We actually found something we had seen before, but where we had seen it before was in our California vineyards because it was Zinfandel. So we actually matched a sample they sent us was something we had, which was California Zinfandel, so we had found it growing in Croatia. They ultimately found it growing in a couple of places, going by a couple of different names, and then they also found an old dried-up specimen in a museum, which represented varieties that had been grown in Croatia 100 years ago, and at first, we couldn't get DNA out of that, because it's an old dried-up specimen in a museum. It's a dried leaf. But then they found some Croatian colleagues who knew how to get DNA out of ancient specimens of all kinds, got the DNA out. That museum specimen was also Zinfandel. It was labeled Tribadrag. Mm. And that then kind of unlocked the key to Tribadrag. Yvonne and Eddie found a Croatian historian with an interest in trade, ancient wines, got him involved. He researched the name Tribadrag, and he was able to trace it back to the 1300s, at which time it was in all kinds of trade records, land records, wills, tax records. And so it was already, by 1300, it was a prominent wine being produced on the Dalmatian coast of what we now today call Croatia, but then it was called Dalmatia, ancient wine-producing area. And so what we have concluded is that if in the early 1300s it was already prominent, it must have already been around for a while. So we don't have evidence, but we suspect that it had already been around for several centuries before we actually have the documentation from the 1300s. So that's why we now know that Tribadrag, or as we call it today, Zinfandel, is a really ancient grape variety. It was the queen of the Adriatic wine trade long before Cabernet Sauvignon was even a glint in the eye of its parents in Bordeaux.
That is a noble grape.
Absolutely, and this is my personal campaign to get Zinfandel recognized as one of the world's noble grapes.
It's interesting in their research and trying to discover the history of their grapes, they also were getting involved with discovering the present and future of that same variety, the Zinfandel.
Yes, and that's a very good point in that Croatia, being a post-communist country, although it has a very long heritage, a couple of thousand years of growing grapes and making wine, as old as anybody in the whole Mediterranean area, all those grapes have Slavic names, which are unpronounceable to an international wine trade that is dominated by Western European grapes with French and Italian and Portuguese and Spanish names. So Croatia has been struggling to join the global wine market. And I think the discovery that Zinfandel comes from there has opened a door for them. They now can stake their claim as the homeland of an ancient and widely recognized and very popular grape. And although Zinfandel had almost disappeared from Croatia, there were just a handful of vines left. And had we started our research 5 or 10 years later, it might have been completely extinct, and then we never would have found it. But now there is quite a big effort to reestablish it. There are a number of winemakers in Croatia now who are very savvy people. They fully appreciate the significance of producing Zinfandel there and perhaps even calling it Zinfandel. A lot of the few vines that were left were heavily virus infected, not very productive. Cuttings from those vines have been sent to UC Davis. They have been tested for virus diseases. They have been treated to eliminate the virus disease. Healthy plants have been recovered, have been sent back to Croatia. A mother block has been established overlooking the Adriatic. It's a beautiful site. And those vines, as they grow up, will become the mother vines for a new generation of Zinfandel to be grown in the homeland, but under, you know, better conditions, better viticultural methods, better disease control methods, better winemaking methods. So whereas it was once lost because of some disease pressures, it now can experience a resurgence in its homeland, and perhaps Croatia can join the rest of Western Europe on the viticultural map.
Well done.
Thank you. Proud of the work.
And rightly so. What a story. Even at this point, nearly 20 years later, Zinfandel is not really considered a noble grape. But now that you've heard the story, I think you'll agree it deserves to be one. What I think is very cool is Carol and her husband Steve grow a delicious spicy Zinfandel on their Mount Veeder property and call it Tribadrag, as a nod to its heritage. They also bottle another ancient variety, Mondus, from the Rhone Alps region of eastern France. It's considered Syrah's grandparent. And Syrah is also a variety Carol grows along with Malbec. You can't go wrong with either of their wines at lagiermeredith.com. L-A-G-I-E-R, Meredith with two E's, .com. Stay here. Kendall Jackson's wine master Randy Ullum is coming up. And now it's time for Wine Uncorked. For centuries, the French monk Dom Perignon is thought to have invented champagne in 1667. But that is being challenged by the Brits, who are saying an English scientist, physician, and naturalist first documented how to put the fizz into sparkling wine 30 years earlier in 1662. According to Winchcombe historian Jean Bray, the scientist Christopher Merritt was the first person to describe the process or use the word sparkling when referring to the end product. To honor his discovery, a plaque has been mounted on Merritt's home. You know, I wonder how that news has been accepted by the French. I think I have a pretty good idea. That's this week's Wine Uncorked. My next interview is with Randy Ullum. You may not be familiar with that name, but Randy is the wine master at Kendall Jackson. He's been there for 28 years and oversees the entire Kendall Jackson portfolio. And that includes the number one selling Chardonnay in America, the Kendall Jackson Vintners Reserve Chardonnay. It's topped the sales list for Chardonnay for 2.5 decades. That's astounding. Randy's been in the business for quite a while. He's long in the tooth, but you'll hear he still retains a youthful energy and wears a smile easily. Randy got inspired to get into the wine industry after a trek through Chile.
There can't be too many winemakers who can say that.
Well, that's for sure. And this was a long time ago, too. I don't really want to admit how many years ago, but it starts with a 4, and it's 2 digits. So this was back in the early days. I actually was 18 when I went down to Chile and left when I was 21 there. It was an exciting time in my life and, of course, in the history of Chile. But when I went there, I went there to go skiing, and I did not realize that it was a wine country, like number 10 on the wine countries in the world. And I liked wine. I was the sort of the odd man out back in America. Or here in America back then, everybody liked beer at that age. And when I got down there and realized how they had all these different kinds of wines, and after spending 3 years there and really learning about, you know, what the country had to offer and meeting people who explained about, you know, the viticulture and winemaking and sales, and then being taught by some other friends about wines of the world, and then the food and the cuisine and how all that worked. When I left, I thought, geez, I've got to get into this business. I got to get paid to taste.
Right. Boy, what an education. But what kept you down there for 3 years? Were you just trying to learn a little bit about the business?
I actually went down just for, it was a 3-month trip to South America. The first month was going to be just in Chile to go skiing. And there was a very unique situation going on there. It was a democratically elected socialist government quickly going to communism. So it was like the Wild West. And the economy was something that you rarely ever get to experience, 1,000% inflation. There's some interesting things that go along with that. It was too exciting to leave. I just had to, you know, cherish this. And it, so that 1 month in Chile ended up being 3 years.
Wow. So you do make it back home, and you entered the Enology program at Ohio State. And I don't think I've ever talked with a winemaker who went to Ohio State. But that's not terribly surprising because Ohio was one of the first successful wine regions in the U.S.
Absolutely. When you think about the East Coast and the east side of the Midwest, you know, that area encompasses Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Missouri, New York, and using the Great Lakes as a way to moderate the cool temperatures in the winter and to extend the growing season, it's a great area for that. And of course, you know, the Concord grape kind of emanated from Concord, Massachusetts, near Lexington and Boston, the birthplace of America. So you have this Vitis Americana style of grapes. They don't make the best wine in the world, to tell you the truth, but it is a viticultural area, and there are wineries there, and everybody's trying. So what I learned first out of school is if you can grow grapes, for starters, in that inclement climate and then make some wine out of it, you can do that anywhere in the world.
And then you ended up going up to Upper New York State. And that wine region is actually doing quite well right now.
It is. So my first job was in outside of Cleveland in Ohio, right along Lake Erie. And then that was for 1 year. And then I went up to New York for 5 years along the same lake, kind of through Pennsylvania and up towards Westfield, New York. I was there for 5 years and then decided that it was kind of like a dead end street there. Actually, before I went to New York, I came to California to look for a job, and actually was offered a job, ironically, at Buena Vista, and that was at the end of a 5-year drought. And being from the east, where everything's green and lush, and then you come out to, you know, this dry, arid state of California that everybody talks about, and it was dusty and dirty. And I thought, how could anyone in their right mind live here? And so I actually turned the job down and went back and worked the 5 years in New York, and then realized maybe I need to go try it again in California, and landed a job and had a different mindset. Now the hills are not, you know, dirty, dusty brown. They're golden.
Yes, and plenty of green vineyards too. And this was 1981, and you were working at Deloge.
That is correct. I was hired by Cecil and Christine Deloach in the day, just as they were getting started. It was basically the first year of them going into being a production winery, or maybe the second year. But we started out really small and grew to well over 100+ thousand cases. And we specialized in Chardonnay and then, of course, Pinot and Zinfandels. And just had a great time doing it. When I started, it was so small that one third of my job was driving the tractor in the vineyard. The other third was acting as a carpenter, helping to build all the new parts to the winery, and one third in the winery. And then as we grew, each piece started dropping off until ultimately, it was a full time and a half winemaking job there.
Yeah, you became winemaker and vice president, I understand.
Exactly, and that was an honor to be promoted up to vice president. It's a good family-run winery. We had a lot of fun together, and growing through in all the different phases of life that you go through in a fast-growing winery setting is very, very exciting. Every year is different.
I want to make sure people understood what you said a minute ago, that you took that winery from about 10,000 cases to 120,000 cases in the time you were there. That's huge growth.
Right. Well, we were very fortunate because we had some, obviously being in Sonoma County, West County, it was great for Chardonnay and Pinot, and we were making some very nice Chardonnays. Well, all the wines were nice, but our Chardonnay is what was sort of our flagship there. And it just kept, you couldn't make enough of it. It was amazing.
Is that what caught the eye of Jess Jackson while you were there? Did he see what you were doing, and did he offer you a job?
Yeah, he offered me a job twice, actually. Once I wasn't ready to leave, and then the second time I was thinking, maybe it's time to try something new, and it was basically because of the Chardonnay. We had turned out to be very similar, if not almost identical, palates, especially for Chardonnay. And then the other was he learned that I had been in Chile and loved Chile and liked to travel back and forth to Chile, and he was dying to have someone go down to Chile and create a new brand and open a winery down there for him. So it was a match made in heaven.
Yeah, I saw that, and I was going to ask you, as you noticed in my questions, that did he know that you had that inspirational background years before?
He did. Absolutely.
But you did a lot of other things in that first year you were there, which was 1991. He had you go up to Mendocino and reopen Ed Mead's. Then you got involved with the Camelot label in Central California, and then you went to Chile. So,
right. Yeah,
that was a busy year for you.
That was like all in the span of 3 months. First Santa Barbara and get that show on the road, and then up to Mendocino and Ed Mead's and get that going. And then by Thanksgiving, a trip down to Chile, kind of figure out the game plan there. And then the following February, we crushed our first grapes in Chile. So it was bing, bang, boom.
What was his desire to work in Chile so early on at that time?
Well, there were two reasons. One, Jess wanted to become a world company and not just make wine in California and America. He wanted to expand. So he had a whole game plan, which we can get into in a minute. But Chile really is just like California, off by 6 months. So you have the Pacific, you have the Humboldt Current, you've got the cold Pacific, so the cool coast of Chile is like the cool coast of California, where all the fine grapes are grown, and you have all these different areas going from north to south. And he figured at some point there's going to be a limitation on grape-growing land in California, which there already is, and where do you go to continue that same vein? Well, to emulate California, it's Chile. And so that was the rationale, to be able to continue and perpetuate that. But then, so to continue on, then Jess really, he had this whole vision. And so when I came, he had just purchased a large chunk of land in Italy, and so there was a couple hundred acres of vineyard, and we were redeveloping that and getting that going in the Chianti area. We had a project in northern Italy, a project down in the Boot. We had a project going on in the south of France. That we decided not to continue with that. We focused on basically Chianti in Italy. He sent me to Argentina. We opened a winery, or built a winery and purchased a bunch of land and developed vineyards there, which we subsequently sold when they had their financial crisis. But then off I went to Australia to create Yangara, and then that's plenty.
What a great career you have. But at that time, which was years ago, you're probably thinking, man, I've reached the pinnacle here of winemaking.
Yeah, you would think that, and I'm very blessed and very honored, for sure. But then Jess asked me to take over Kendall Jackson. They said, well, Andy, you need to stay home a little bit more. You can't quite travel that much and focus on KJ. And of course, we have all these different tiers at Kendall Jackson and a lot of vineyards, over probably 13,000 acres or so, 12,000 back then, up and down just the coast of California. So it's Mendocino, Napa, Sonoma, Lake County, Monterey, and Santa Barbara. But spectacular vineyard sites and wineries in each place and different vineyard managers and all these different flavors and varieties that are grown. So it's quite the challenge.
And as you mentioned, you both had a great palate for Chardonnay, and he had this idea to make a wonderful tasting Chardonnay that most of America could afford. And that went off really well, didn't it?
Yeah, it was a home run, actually, because you didn't need to have a PhD to understand what you were drinking. It was pleasant, pleasurable, it smelled good, it tasted good, it had a nice, creamy, long finish, it just beckoned for another sip. It brought a smile to everyone's face, and they just couldn't stop sipping and drinking it, and the rest is history.
Now, do I understand that it has been the top-selling Chardonnay for 24 years now?
It's actually now 25 years. Number one selling Chardonnay in America. We're very, very proud of that. And it's all barrel fermented. Well, 95% barrel fermented for the Vintner's Reserve, which is a feat in itself, but it's a testament to the quality.
Now, it's got to be a challenge to make that taste the same year in and year out, because that's what that consumer is expecting. How do you handle that?
The part of the trick to that is the ratio of the grapes from the different areas along the coast. And we try to keep that more or less similar, and since we own and supply the majority of all the grapes that we use, it's very easy to do that, as long as we can maintain those percentages, because you get a different flavor from each area. So as an example, up Mendocino gives you the crisp green apple tone. The part of the Russian River gives you ripe apple. Carneros, the pear tones and pear oil. And then you go down to Monterey and you get the lemon and the lime, the citrine character. And then the part of the Chardonnay that comes from Santa Barbara is the tropical, like pineapple-y tone. So if you can maintain those, you know, ratios more or less, you can keep it going year in and year out because you've got the same source. And then you maintain your barrel ferment and your ratios of new oak and not get too crazed with the oak part. It's not that challenging.
Yeah. I think you can get that for like $17.
Well, yeah, that's we call the MSRP, manufacturer suggested retail price. More often than not, if you're in California, it's $10, $12, $14, at your local stores. Pretty good deal.
Okay, I'd like to interject here. I have to admit, it had been many years since I had a Kendall Jackson Vintner's Reserve Chardonnay, but after hearing Randy describe the flavors, I was inspired to hit a grocery store on the way home. And it was about $12. And yes, it's an affordable wine, but you can taste each of those flavors. It's silky, without much oak or buttery flavors, and I could taste why it sells so well.
The challenging part is putting the blend together because we keep all the lots separate. So we'll have over 1,000 different lots that we're trying to taste and manage. And that's more of the challenge, is working with all those lots.
But somehow you have to remember year after year after year when you're doing the blending what the end result's going to be.
Well, you project what that end result is going to be, and you compare it to what you've already done. And you're constantly, when you're tasting all these wines, thinking, well, what do we need to do? So a little bit more butter, malolactic, a little bit more toast. Of course, we stir the lees on everything. But it's a challenge for sure. We kind of wax eloquence over all this. It's a piece of cake. But it is a tactical challenge.
And I'm sure plenty of note-taking and reading.
A lot of notes are taken, that's for sure. And we have a great team. We couldn't do this without the team that we have. And a lot of the folks on the winemaking team have been with us for 20-plus years also. So it becomes just second nature after you've done it for a number of years.
So tell us about Jess Jackson. What was the guy like? I mean, he was obviously driven. And he must have done well in the 80s to be able to afford all that he did in the 90s.
Well, he did well. I mean, Jess was just a regular old guy. He was an attorney that sort of fell into making wine and having a winery. He was an attorney until he was 50, and he had purchased a piece of land up in Lake County just to go for weekends, because he lived in San Francisco with his family, and it had some grapes, and he planted some more grapes. And this was probably in the 70s, and he was selling his production every year to Barney Fetzer. in that neck of the woods. And then there was the grape, one of many grape crises, and this was in the 78, I believe, thereabouts. And so Barney canceled his contract, and all of a sudden there's Jess with all these grapes, and he's figuring, I'll be damned if I'm going to let them hang on the vine and rot. So he decided to make wine out of them. Made some wine that went okay. So then the next year he made more wine and actually bottled it, and he bought other grapes, some from vineyards that we still are sourcing from today, talking about continuity from day one in Monterey and Santa Barbara. So he bought some other grapes and decided to make some wine. It was like 18 or 20,000 cases, and it was a wonderful Chardonnay. And he decided he decided to be the, you know, the winemaker. He was the PR guy, he was the marketing guy, and he was the sales guy. And so he went off to
and already up to 18, 19,000 cases.
That's right out of the gate.
That's not small.
No, but he was a gambler, believe it or not. You'd never see him in a casino, but he would gamble with life and on these strategies. And he was sharp as a tack. He had this infectious energy and vitality and enthusiasm, always with a smile, always challenging you, but just the nicest guy with the biggest heart and an incredible palate. And he had a palate that was consumer-friendly. And that's why the wine really was a success. So he took that, you know, that first year's production and sold it, and decided, huh, I'm getting out of the, you know, the law business. I'm gonna start this. And so it just started growing and growing. He didn't walk into this with a huge sum of money that was just given to him or a windfall. He started from scratch and worked his way up through all of this. And his success, he kept investing everything into the company. Into the land, because he loved the land. That's where his heart and soul was. So he was adamant about being in charge of his own destiny.
Yeah, I knew he was a lawyer. I'm sure he had a successful career as a lawyer, but yeah, that doesn't give you the amount of money to kick up a winery. So he must have been very smart at what he did.
Well, he is highly intelligent, and Barbara Banky is highly intelligent also. And the two of them made a formidable team, and Barbara is carrying on the tradition, you know, and then some of what just started. But he was very tactical, and you know, when the market would go to the right, he'd go to the left, and it was always the right move. And he was in the right place at the right time for so many things. And people really thought, oh my God, who is this maverick out there? And took the world by storm.
Yeah, he was kind of one of the newer of that generation, wasn't he? I mean, you had Mondavi, and you had a few others along the way, but he sure made a name for himself.
Very, very quickly, because we're only 35 years old. Imagine that, you know, from zero to where we are today as a company, and starting with Kendall Jackson as the first label, and then came Cambria. Then, of course, they purchased Ed Meads, and now as a group, you know, Jackson Family Wines, we have pushing 50 different brands around the world, and a lot up and down the state of California, and we've ventured into Oregon too. So it's quite exciting. And the neat thing is, every brand has its own identity, its own way of making the wines, its own winemaker. Everything is kept separate. And a lot of people think, oh, you know, we've gotten big and we just have gigantic tanks and this, that, and the other thing. We're the complete opposite. We started small and we still have a small winery mentality on keeping everything separate and then ultimately blending things together. But it's pretty, pretty darn cool.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, how do you oversee all of that? Because it's huge. You mentioned over 50 or close to 50 properties and brands. And I thought it was 30 something, but you're way beyond that.
Oh, way beyond. I mean, it just keeps growing. But we have a tremendous people, tremendous team. And, you know, the winemakers, the general managers, the vineyard managers, the guys, you know, in the vineyard, you know, tending to the vines, and the cellar crew. And then, of course, a fantastic leadership team here. So it's just grown and grown and grown and keeps on growing.
You're just the long gray-haired wizard who sits up on the hill just making sure everything is running smoothly, aren't you?
Well, we try. I mean, we have our ways. But the bottom line to all of this is quality and over-delivering, basically. And quality trumps everything. Every conversation, if somebody get into it with, like, the finance guys on how much something costs, you know, would come down to, okay, here are two glasses of wine. Shall we discuss this ourselves, or should we let Jess make the decision? And at the end of the day, it was quality prevailed no matter what. And that's what's really gotten us to where we are now. It's being a family-run company. It's not about, you know, the next quarter's income statement or what have you, because we'll all the shareholders, like a public company, and we have one shareholder, that's Barbara. And effectively, you know, you can stop on a dime and turn on a dime, and a division, which is from a winemaker's perspective, always having the best land, the best grapes, the best people, the best winery, the best equipment to make the best wines possible, but with a vision. You know, and it's not just a one-year vision. It's 20, it's 50, it's 100. Sometimes it's the vision, believe it or not, it's 200 years. I mean, we'll all be dead. But they're planning for the future generations. It's quite an honor.
As they have in Burgundy and Italy, and they've been doing that for centuries.
Right. And so when we're 500 years old, we'll still be around. You know, Jackson Family Wines, with Lord knows how many little Jackson grandchildren or great-grandchildren running around, but I would love to be able to look back somehow, you know, if I were going to be alive, you know, 250 years from now, to see how it was. But I know it'll be fantastic.
Well, if you are the wizard, maybe you will be alive.
One never knows. We might find that secret.
Aside from the great list of brands they own, you may not realize that if you're not a club member or have been to the tasting room, the Kendall Jackson brand has a number of different tiers of wine, from the affordable to the level of a luxury brand. So I asked Randy to take us through the different tiers they offer.
So we at Kendall Jackson, we have what we call our broad market wines that are, you know, sold across the country and around the world, which is the Vintner's Reserve tier. And we have all, you know, the major varieties there: Pinot, Zin, Syrah, Cab, Chardonnay, Merlot, things like that. And then Sauvignon Blanc and Riesling also. Then we have the Grand Reserve. And the Grand Reserve is basically our favorite lots that would represent, you know, if you were going to try to figure it out numerically, you'd say, the top 6% of a given variety of our favorite lots will go into the Grand Reserve. And then we have, and the Grand Reserve will be more county-based or even Appalachian-based. And then we have what are called the Jackson Estate Appellation tier and the Jackson Estate Vineyard tier. The Appalachian tier is, there's only three: a Pinot from Anderson Valley and Mendocino, a Chardonnay from the Santa Maria Valley and Santa Barbara, and a Cabernet from the Alexander Valley and Sonoma. That's only for restaurants. And then we have their sister tier, which would be those same areas but from a specific vineyard: Camelot for the Chardonnay, Hawkeye for the Cab, and Outland Ridge for the Pinot. And so those are, you know, limited, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 cases kind of thing for what we call the three-tier system, you know, anywhere. And then we also have the very pinnacle of our winemaking endeavors. It's called Stature. And that's a Cabernet that is a mountain-based cab from Knights Valley and the Alexander Valley, but of vineyards of elevation. In fact, all of the vineyards, well, 85% of the vineyards that we own are from either mountains, ridges, hillsides, or benches. We really don't like or have any vineyards in the true valley floor because they're too productive for us. We're looking for concentration and lower yields. So those are the tiers that we have. In the Stature, we have a Cabernet and a Chardonnay. And that basically does it. So we go from, you know, maybe a million and change-ish cases for our Chardonnay to Vintner's Reserve Chardonnay to like 80 cases maybe for the Stature Chard.
Yeah.
We have the gamut in both volumetrics, quality, and price.
And price, yes. Yes. So I was going to ask you about that. I'm glad you brought that up, the Kendall Jackson Vintner's Reserve Chardonnay. You're over a million cases?
Yes, yes, and change.
Yeah.
Yeah, and very quite proud of it.
And this mindset of getting away from that buttery, oaky Chardonnay is not affecting you guys very much?
No, I mean, we never went there. So, you know, we have a kiss of butter, a kiss of oak. There was a period of time where everybody thought the more oak, the better. But we have not changed that for years. We've just held our way, and, you know, we're very, very reliant upon oak barrels, for sure. But it's the fermentation part and a kiss of toastiness. But to the degree that we're half owners of a stave mill over in France to guarantee and ensure the quality of our barrels and the age of our barrels and the source of our barrels, the oak, sourcing oak in France by the different forests is kind of like sourcing Chardonnay in California by the different appellations and regions. You get different nuances from each forest.
Well, that's great that you have part ownership, because that's certainly creating consistency and sticking with it.
That's, yeah, another one of our secrets.
So you've been at it a long time. Are you thinking about like a lot of winemakers do, I'm going to eventually just get away from the big corporate world and just make my own little wine and have my own label before I give it up?
You know, a lot of people ask me that, and I've been very fortunate and very blessed to do what I've done here at Kendall Jackson and with Jess. You know, I've gone off and basically started wineries from scratch. I do all of those as if they are my own, but for him and the company. So I've done so many of those that I don't need to go out and experience that again on my own. So I'm content, and I've focused on making, you know, small little lots. We do direct to consumer lots that nobody sees unless they come to our wine center, and our the guys I work with work on them. We have our special wines we all have a chance to do. So I feel completely fulfilled already, having worked all these years at with the Jackson family.
Well, I sure appreciate your time and sharing your story with us.
Oh, it's an honor and a pleasure. And it's always fun to, you know, let people know a little bit more about the wine world and what goes on and how people got started. And it's just everybody in the wine business and the food business and the restaurant business, everybody's so kind and wonderful and always happy for some reason.
I wonder why that is. Yeah, I tell you, I have a joy doing this job and talking with people. And all of you are all very approachable. And I love sharing your stories because they're all so unique.
All unique. And everybody in the you know, basically the wine business, be it the grape side or the wine side, are very down-to-earth people, salt of the earth, and that's what it takes.
Randy Ullum, the winemaster of the entire Kendall Jackson portfolio. You can see his photo, read more about him, and learn a lot more about Kendall Jackson at simplykj.com. You can find more interviews and tasty nuggets of information at onthewineroad.com, and I'm on Instagram and Twitter at jdwineroad. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast, and I look forward to you joining me again on the Wine Road.